From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Today, National Geographic photographer Joel Satore, who created the Photo Ark, a project to document all the 12,000 species of the world's animals in zoos, wildlife rehabs, and aquariums before they become extinct. He's been at it for 15 years. He uses studio-style lighting and backdrops to take beautiful portraits of them.
And the majority of the animals that are in the photo arc are not gorillas, rhinos, and polar bears. They're mice, and they're toads, and they're sparrows, and they're animals that will never have their voices heard before they go away, before they're led off to extinction.
He has a new book of photo arc photographs. Also, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a DVD reissue of the movie version of the 1955 musical Damn Yankees. And I'll review the new Netflix comedy drama series, The Politician, co-created by Ryan Murphy. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Imagine what it would look like if a rhino, a leopard, a grizzly bear, an ostrich, a warthog, an alligator, a double-headed turtle, a giant clam, a warty pig, a striped tree frog, and thousands of other animals came to a photo studio to sit for their portraits. That's never going to happen. So Joel Sartore does the next best thing. He creates a version of a portrait studio wherever the animals are. Sartore is a National Geographic contributing photographer and fellow. In addition to his assignments in the wild, he's taken on the project of documenting the world's animal species that are currently under human care. In other words, a representative of each animal species in zoos, wildlife rehab centers, and aquariums. These are animals who are on the verge of extinction, or are endangered, or may soon be. His goal is to document them before they disappear. He hopes that by taking beautiful photos of them, more people will care about these animals and ensure that they have a future for the benefit of the animals, humans, and Earth's ecosystem. His project is called the Photo Ark, and when Terry Gross spoke to him in 2017, he'd already photographed 6,500 different species and published an accompanying photo book. Since then, he's published two more Photo Ark books. The latest, called Vanishing, the World's Most Vulnerable Animals, came out this month.
Joel Sartore, welcome to Fresh Air. So why did you decide to do animals who are under human care as opposed to animals in the wild? Because there's a lot of animals in the wild that aren't going to be represented in your
right.
ARC project.
Sure, there's millions of species in the wild, and there's, you know, about 12,000, maybe 13,000 animals in captivity. The reason is because I've never been able to talk a tiger into walking out of the woods and coming onto my set and posing. Just can't do it.
You're not very good at this, are you?
No, I'm not. In fact, I haven't even tried. So the reality is that the animals that are in captivity around the world, they're used to people. They've been around people their whole lives, born and raised. And so it's just much easier to convince them to come into a room. And most time we shift animals into a room that's been prepped with black and white, either paint or cloth or paper, and then we feed them during the shoot, and it takes a few minutes, and then they leave, you know. So most of the time they just think they're coming in to get lunch by the time I get there.
Well, I love that you photograph them in a studio-type setting. You basically create studios in the zoo or the wildlife center by setting up a white background
right.
and floor or black background and floor.
Right.
So why do you want to photograph them in that kind of setting as opposed to, like, in the setting that they live in? In whatever, you know, either cage or wildlife setting they
right,
have in
right.
their refuge or zoo or wherever.
Right. Well, I mean, I did that for a long time. I've been a National Geographic photographer for 26 years, something like that, 27. And I photographed the first 15 years or so out in the wild doing stories of different conservation stories, a story on wolves, on grizzly bears, on koalas, all in the wild. And can I say that moved the needle enough to stop the extinction crisis? No. No, it did not. So I just figured maybe very simple portraits lit exquisitely so you can see the beauty and the color, looking animals directly in the eye with no distractions would be the way to do it. And also, on these black and white backgrounds with nothing to have as a size comparison, a mouse is every bit as glorious as an elephant. And a tiger beetle is every bit as big and important as a tiger. So it's a great equalizer. And the majority of the animals that are in the photo arc are not gorillas, rhinos, and polar bears. They're mice, and they're toads, and they're sparrows. And they're animals that will never have their voices heard before they go away, before they're led off to extinction. And so I feel it's a big responsibility to show them all equally and give them equal care and give them an equal voice.
You know, it's funny. It's like the animals are making eye contact with you because you photograph them looking into the lens. It's
right,
like they're looking
right.
into my eyes when I look at the photo.
That's right.
Because of the kind of studio setting that you create, it reminds me a little bit of, like, if the animals had, like, graduation photos.
Right.
Or if their
parents sent
them to the studio to get the photos that then could be framed and put on the wall. You know?
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's right. I mean, it is. It is a series of pictures like that, just exactly like that. We just want to show the animals looking their best and to get people drawn in into the tent of conservation to realize that all of these animals are important and valuable and worth preserving. I mean, after all, really, we'll stand to lose about half of all species by the turn of the next century, by 2100. And it's really folly to think that we can doom half of everything else to extinction, but that people will be just fine. I mean, we have to have pollinating insects to bring us fruits and vegetables. If you want to think of it selfishly, we have to have healthy, intact rainforests to help not only regulate climate, but to make sure our rainfall stays stabilized and predictable and consistent in places like Nebraska, where I live, where we grow crops to feed the world. So really, as these creatures go, so do we.
I love seeing the photos of animals that I'm familiar with, like, you know, a leopard, a rhino. But there's a lot of animals in your book that I'm really not familiar with, including the Bengal slow loris. And
right.
I think this is a little baby right. loris that you
yeah.
have. And
yeah.
so
yeah.
so the loris is in a hand, like somebody
right.
somebody's holding it just for scale, I guess, because it's
right.
tiny. And
right.
there's this like big round eyes and this like adorable fuzzy hair, perfectly round face.
Right.
It's this
right.
like tiny little creature. How old was the loris and what is a Bengal slow loris?
Well, he's just a little primate, and I believe that was photographed in Vietnam, perhaps, at a wildlife rehab center. And they have, you know, a lot of these rehab centers have animals that have been confiscated from the pet trade. The mothers have been killed, and they're sold in the pet trade. And so you're looking at something just a few weeks old, and it's a primate, and it needs abundant attention and care, which are the places I work at. And so... you're seeing a little baby there that needs all the help in the world to make it to adulthood. And then at rehab centers, you know, they grow them back up. They condition them to live in the wild, how to find the right food, and off they go again. So big fan of wildlife rehab centers in general.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So there's a lot of animals that it must be really easy to get to pose, like the little baby loris that fits in the palm of a hand. But then you've got a bison. And people told you
right.
you're not going to be able to get a bison to pose for
right.
you or to even go
right.
into the little studio tent that you set up. So what did
right.
you have to do to get the bison photo?
Right. Well, I should explain to folks, like for small animals, we work with animals that, again, the institution knows that the animal will tolerate going into a little crate or a kennel. They're trained and they let them go out back out into a little tent. But for an animal like a bison, there's no tent big enough. It's a good way to get hurt. So what they did is they painted, this was at the Oklahoma City Zoo, and they painted an off-exhibit space black, and then we waited a day and we painted it white, and we led her in there using mulberry leaves. They could literally park her on a dime using mulberry leaves. They had a herd of bison. They were named after the characters on Gilligan's Island, so she was Mary Ann. She was Mary Ann, and they just put her right there on a dime. And they didn't think that she would do it, but we put the lights up in the ceiling so she couldn't get into them or rip them down. The cords are all tied up against the ceiling up in the beams. And then they just put her right there. And she'd stand there all day long. It was really remarkable.
She
was standing on a painted backdrop and a painted floor. And then they would give her mulberry leaves. And when she'd finish the last leaf and look up at me, I'd say, "Hey, Marianne," and she'd look at me, and then I'd get her picture, and then they'd feed her some more leaves to keep her there, and she'd just, you know, she was just having lunch because she was used to the backdrop. So it's very nice that way.
So
there's a lot of advanced work that goes into these pictures, obviously. Months of work to go to one zoo, just in the prep.
I'll tell you what, why don't we take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more about the animals that you've photographed for your ARC series. And let me reintroduce you here. My guest is Joel Sartori, and he's a photographer, a contributing photographer for National Geographic, and he's trying to document all of the animals under human care in zoos and aquariums, and the photos are really beautiful. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Joel Satori. He's a contributing photographer for National Geographic, and the project he's been working on for over 10 years is the Photo Ark Project. And his goal is to take photos of all of the animals under human care in zoos, in animal rehab centers, and aquariums. And he's gotten over 6,000 of those photos done already. In other words, over 6,000 animals he's documented. We're talking about like doing big animals and small animals. So another big animal that you did was a grizzly bear. And I mean, grizzlies can be very dangerous, which I'm sure you've learned the hard way in the wild because you photographed them in both places. But
I have.
But doing the grizzly bear in the zoo, was the grizzly bear pretty accustomed to humans? Did you have to do anything to protect yourself?
You know, if it's a big animal like that, we're always working behind a protective barrier of some sort, you know, usually wire, metal. But in this case, you know, again, the space is prepped. It's for a big animal. It's prepped. It's painted white and painted black. And that was at the Sedgwick County Zoo in Wichita, Kansas. They get the space ready. The bears used to come in there to have lunch. It's a little off-exhibit space in the back of the zoo. The pictures are taken while he's eating. Whenever he looks up in between tidbits, I think it was just raw meat, he looks up. We get his picture. He looks like he's smiling. And he goes back to it, and then the photo shoot's over. Usually when the animal gets full, that's it for the photo shoot. A lot of food motivation there. So no danger at all, and I listen to what the staff at the zoo says in terms of how close to get. Just never a problem.
So compare the experience of photographing a grizzly in these controlled circumstances for your ARC series to photographing a grizzly in the wild.
Well, I tell you, it's a lot easier photographing them in captivity, and you don't get charged. So I did an entire story on grizzlies for the Geographic years ago, and I remember getting charged on day three of the assignment because, you know, if your pictures aren't good enough, you're not close enough, the old saying goes. And so got too close to a mother with her cubs in Alaska, and I just remembered her charging at me, and it looked like she was shot out of a cannon. She moved so quickly, and I couldn't have run away if I'd wanted to. My feet, I didn't even know I had legs to move. I just stood there with my mouth open, and she didn't touch me, but I thought, boy, this is going to be a long assignment. I had 8 weeks to go. So it's a lot better working with animals that have been around people their whole lives, you know, a lot better.
Hold on. I don't think you finished the story. She came at you like a cannon. You couldn't move.
She did.
And then what?
Oh, and then what? Then she stopped. I don't know. She stopped close enough to me that I could smell her breath when she snorted at me.
Mm.
And I stood there. And I mean, it was just seconds. And then she kind of turned around and trotted back to her cubs. They were feeding on salmon in Katmai National Park in Alaska. So I just shook my head and thought, I was real shaky at that point. I thought, this was really a dumb idea to take this assignment. This is going to be the end of my career because there's just no way I can do this. This is day three. But, you know, if you don't do a great job, you're going to fail and starve and die in that order if you're a freelancer. And so most of the Geographic photographers do freelance by the story. And so I just kept going and tried to be more creative in how I worked with bears. And I started using remote cameras, which allowed me to be very close without being there at all. Some of the cameras would get trashed a little bit, but that's okay. We made a lot of pictures that made the story, and it just taught me to be more respectful, because when you're out there in the wild, you're in the bear's house, you're in their home, and you just have to know bear behavior, which I didn't know very well at the start, and learn from it.
Yeah, this is kind of like the wildlife equivalent of a Hollywood movie star who punches
a paparazzi
who are trying to take their photograph.
Right, that's
You're
right.
You're invading my space.
Totally. Yeah, I've been pushed under. I've been chased by elephants, muskox, grizzlies.
Did they ever get you?
No. I've been made real sick by terrible diseases going to these places. Bites from little insects, but nothing. Nothing in terms of major contact. I mean, I had a flesh-eating parasite from a sandfly bite in Bolivia that took chemo to heal into the top chamber of my heart for a month. That
flesh eating sounds really bad.
Yeah, it's called it was called mucocutaneous leishmaniasis, and it's gets in through through the bite of a sandfly and wants to get in through your lymphatic system and eventually eat more holes in your head, which is bad.
Would eat more holes in your head?
Oh yeah, it just eats away your sinuses, the soft tissue in your head, causes big holes all
over.
Was
this happening to you?
Well, not in my head, but just in my leg, and huge infection. You get bacterial infections from it, and it's just hard to treat.
How many holes did you have?
I had one big hole in my leg, and you want to keep it from getting worse. So the CDC in Atlanta gives your doctor permission to get their treatment, which is a heavy metal called antimony, and it has to be mixed up fresh and served cold, and they put it into your top chamber of your heart using a PICC line, because the drug is corrosive to veins, and they want it to be dispersed into your bloodstream very quickly. So they run this PICC line up your arm into the top chamber of your heart, and the stuff goes in, and you don't feel very good for about a month. And I had that treatment twice for it, because they found it was still alive a year later. But I don't, so far I'm good. But it's the little stuff that really gets you. Like, I came in contact with the Marburg virus, which is like Ebola, a hemorrhagic fever, in a bat cave in Uganda. So I had to be in quarantine for that for 3 weeks. And I didn't get it. I didn't get it, or I probably wouldn't be talking to you. But so working at zoos, it's all right.
I like it. So we were talking earlier about how you get each animal into basically like a little black or white tent so that you can photograph them with a solid backdrop, like an all white or all black backdrop and floor.
Right.
For the bigger animals, you have painted backdrops because you can't get them into a tent. And you feed them as you're photographing them, or somebody feeds them so that they're occupied and happy.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you worked with any animal trainers, because what I'm thinking of here is one of the animal trainers I talked to who works with animals in movies said that when they want the animal to look the person, to look the actor in the eye, what they do is they take a bit of food and sometimes put it on the actor's forehead. So the animal's looking at the food on the actor, but it looks like they're making eye contact with the actor.
Oh, really? I have not tried that. I've not tried putting food on my head.
I think it'd be a bad idea with a grizzly bear, for example.
I think so, too. Well, the closest I've come to that is there's a little white Arctic fox from a zoo in Kansas that's on the spine of the book.
Oh, he's got his head tilted. That photo is so cute. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
He is reacting to me squealing like a pig, because he was not paying any attention to me. So I squealed like a pig once, and he looked, and then I tried it again, and it didn't work. So I got one frame of him. He was a educational animal, hand-raised and taken to zoos to educate school kids. So he was really used to people and being handled. And he just could not have cared less about his picture being taken. But the pig squeal stopped him in his tracks. There he was.
So describe the pose that he's in.
Well, he's just sitting there. He was in the middle of their vet clinic. We outfitted that with black velvet floor and black velvet walls, and put lights overhead, and he was just sniffing everything, very curious, eager to go meet people, because he was this outreach animal. And he really didn't care about anything other than just exploring. So that was the one moment he stopped. That's about all I got, really.
Are you good at squealing like a pig?
Well, I've been known to be pretty good at it, from Nebraska and all.
Can we hear one?
Okay, you ready? It only works once, though.
Very convincing.
Thank you. Animals in zoos, see, they've heard it all. People are shouting and yelling and not being very nice. And so I had to come up with something that would work. I'm glad to say that I squealed like a pig with Terry Gross. I mean, I'm such a big fan. I mean, I dressed up for this show, and it's radio.
And I'm not even in the same studio as you, so you're not impressing me at all with your clothing.
No, but I'm dressed up for this. I'm wearing clean clothes, even.
Which you don't do when you're photographing animals, I suppose.
Absolutely. There's no point. There's no point.
No, am I being like overly anthropomorphic when I say, oh, that little white fox, it was so cute, because it's a beautiful photo. It makes me want to like pet the little fox, but it's a fox, it's not a puppy.
Right. They're not pets. But really that's the goal. If we can get some eye contact going with something that is a baby or looks really cute or is, anthropomorphic, kind of looks like us, looks mad or happy, That's good stuff because it engages people. It changes their mind about how they feel about animals. It draws them in. And that's the whole point. The point of this isn't to just create this giant archive. The point is to get people to know that the world needs all of our help. It needs us to be better in terms of our consumer choices and how we live our lives and what we consume and whatever it takes. I mean, already in the 11 years I've been doing this, we've had several species go extinct that I photographed. And I never thought I would see that in my life.
What are some examples of that? Animals you photoed?
Some of the animals that I've photographed, the Columbia Basin pygmy rabbit from eastern Washington State is no more. A couple species of frog, an insect or two, we think. It's really hard to say precisely, but we're pretty sure that they're gone now. And people ask if that makes me sad, and no, it just angers me a little and motivates me to want to tell their story.
Photographer Joel Satore speaking to Terry Gross in 2017. Vanishing, the latest volume of photographs from his ongoing PhotoArc project, was published this month. After a break, we'll hear more of their conversation. Also, Damn Yankees, the movie version of the 1955 musical, which brought choreographer Bob Fosse and dancer Gwen Verdon together, has just been reissued on DVD. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, has a review. And I'll review the latest Ryan Murphy TV series, The Politician, which premieres today on Netflix. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from HarperCollins, publisher of The Dutch House by Anne Patchett, exploring the bond between two siblings, their childhood home, and a past that won't let go. Now in hardcover, ebook, and audiobook, performed by Tom Hanks. And from Capital One, offering a variety of credit card options with features for a range of customers, from foodies to travelers. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Credit approval required. Capital One Bank, USA, NA.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross, back with more of Terry's 2017 interview with Joel Sartore, a National Geographic contributing photographer and fellow. For nearly 15 years, he's been taking photographs of each animal species under human care in zoos, aquariums, and wildlife rehabilitation centers. Many of these animals are on the verge of extinction or may soon be. His goal is to document them before it's too late. The project is called the PhotoArc, and the latest volume in that project, a collection of photos titled Vanishing, was published this month.
So a lot of the work you've done for this series is in zoos, and I'll mention again, you've done a lot of work, a lot of wildlife photography, but this project is not in the wild. So a lot of the photography has been in zoos. Has your opinion of zoos changed over the years?
Yeah, it has somewhat. I mean, I grew up going to the Omaha Zoo, grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, Ralston to be specific, and that was my zoo growing up. And I started the PhotoArc at the Lincoln Children's Zoo, a mile from my house, and I just have so much respect for them now. I mean, I literally see that zoos are the arks now. They are kind of the keepers of the kingdom. They're saving critically endangered animals that would be extinct by now.
And they, but that's changed, hasn't it? I mean, I always thought in the past, I think zoos were more like prisons for human entertainment.
No, well, I mean, I tell you, they started out 100 years ago as menageries, but as the decades have gone by, man, they're conservation centers now. And right. they're all that stands between extinction and survival for many of the species I photograph. They only exist in zoos. The other thing that's important to remember is that zoos are really important education centers as our populace becomes more and more urban mm-hmm. and less likely to encounter animals in the wild. Zoos are the only place where they can go and learn and be excited and see and smell and hear live animals. So this is it's a critical role going forward. If you try to imagine a world without zoos, you're going to be thinking about people are just, they're just not going to care. They're not going to miss what they don't know.
In your book, you profile some people who are doing really important work with endangered species.
Yes.
And one of the people you profile is Thilo Nadler, who mm-hmm. Runs an endangered primate rescue center in, I think yes. it's Vietnam?
Yes.
And you write that he cares for mistreated animals who were part of the exotic pet trade
yes.
and seized by the government. So, but once right. the government seizes them from the illegal traders or poachers, does the government not have anything to do with them? I mean,
correct.
Like,
they don't,
what does the government
do
with these animals after they've rescued them?
Well, they used to euthanize them because they didn't have a place to put them.
Oh.
And Thilo saw that, and he was like, he's quoted in the book, it wasn't my work or my profession, but what could I do? He was an electronics specialist, and he's like, what could I do? I couldn't let these animals get euthanized. So he would take in these primates, and now he has successful breeding colonies of these animals, and they're in big enclosures, and they're fed native vegetation right out of Cuc Pham National Park there in Vietnam, and they're breeding, and they've got lots of babies, and the truth is he is a time capsule or a containment vessel until people put away their guns and quit shooting everything out of the forest there in Vietnam. He has a big percentage of the world's population of three or four different species there. And he's tried releasing them in the wild and they all get shot and eaten. He started a project that he knew in his lifetime would never be complete. He's buying time for many of these animals, hoping that people will quit shooting them and people will leave the forests intact. I really admire that. This is a guy that's up against big odds. We profile a lot of people in this book who were up against the same thing. Don and Ann Butler of Pheasant Heaven in Clinton, North Carolina. They're breeding species of pheasants, one species of pheasant that's extinct in the wild in Vietnam now. When I visited them, they had 11 or 12% of the world's population in their aviaries breeding them. And it's a big responsibility. If breeders like that quit, the bird would go extinct. Jack Rudlow at Gulf Specimen, which is a marine lab, in Panacea, Florida, he educates school kids as to the importance of mainly marine invertebrates. Kind of a thankless job, you know, but they're amazing. These are people that work every day, not for the glory or any other reason than they want to see the world preserved. So I really admire these people.
Now, I read that you bought 1,200 acres in Nebraska, where you live, in an attempt to save a rare bird. Can you tell us what
I
that's
did.
About?
Well, my wife had cancer, and she's okay now, but she had cancer, and when she came out of it, she didn't care what I did with our money. And there was two square miles of alkali wetlands and really steep uplands out in the sandhills by Alliance, and I went and toured it with the rancher. I've been out there exactly one time before I bought it, and I toured it with the rancher, and I said, do long-billed curlews breed here? And he said, yes, they do, all over the place. And I was like, that's good enough. So there's still some cattle run on it, but it's done in a respectful way. And there's a lot of migrating shorebirds that go through there, avocets and sandpipers and the curlews. And I just thought, that'd be pretty cool, you know? I mean, I see a lot of stuff that's not that fun when I travel to especially developing nations in Asia and Africa. I see a lot of wildlife being consumed and eaten. I just wanted to save a little piece. I wanted to save a little corner, protect something.
So you bought 1,200 acres that you're just leaving alone so that the wildlife there can continue to live there or pass through there during
mm-hmm.
migrations.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So when you say your wife no longer cared after she had cancer, what you did with the money. Why didn't she care anymore?
You know, cancer has a way of really clarifying things. She just realized life was short, and so did I, and she just didn't care what we did with our money. She just wanted to be healthy, and I wanted her healthy too, but cancer is a profound experience, something many of us are touched by, if not all of us. And it actually created the photo arc. She'd been pretty good about letting me run all over the world for many, many years doing these geographic stories, one after the next. And then she was diagnosed with a pretty large tumor in her right breast. And I found myself grounded for the first time in my life. Stayed home for a year while she went through chemo and radiation. We had three kids at home. The youngest one had just turned two. I hadn't even changed a diaper on that kid. I was not a great father. I mean, a loving father, but not home very much. And so all of a sudden I was home, grounded. And I just thought, okay, well, is she going to make it? I thought about that mostly. Are we going to lose our house because I can't go out and shoot anymore for the magazine? And I thought about what we would do. And then it became apparent she was getting better. The chemo was working, and it's been 12 years now, and she's fine. But in those days when things were going real good and we were on our way back out of the darkness, I would walk around the house kind of by myself when our youngest was sleeping and just look at the walls. And I had a lot of prints up of Audubon's work, John James Audubon, of birds and mammals, some of which are extinct now in the birds. And he was a great painter, but he was also a great naturalist. And he gave us our only descriptions of what these animals would act like, how they behave, these birds that are extinct. And I thought, wow, that guy gave his full measure of devotion. He worked his entire life to bring us this. And it stood through time. And then I had a book in my library on Edward Curtis, Shadow Catcher, that I hadn't looked at. So I looked at that, and, you know, he gave his full measure of devotion, I guess, his entire life to documenting the customs, the ways of dress, housing, religious ceremonies, everything on Native Americans, because he felt pretty strongly that European settlement was going to alter their way of life significantly. So he spent 30 years just working on that one thing. And I thought, you know what, these magazine stories come and go in a month, but if I could create a project that would stick, that'd be cool. So that's how it started, you know. I'm kind of an obsessive guy, and, you know, maybe not the most talented, but certainly energetic. And so here we are today at 6,500 species, and I'm talking to Terry Gross on Fresh Air.
Did it give you pause at all, though, knowing that this project that you designed for yourself after your wife had cancer would take you away from her and your children for long periods of time because you're traveling to zoos around the world, to wildlife rehab centers around the world?
Yeah, that's kind of a drag. I mean, life's flying by. Every year seems to get busier, but if it's a choice between photographing an animal that's the very last one in captivity and there are none left in the wild, I mean, I don't have a choice. This is the only chance these animals are ever going to be heard. This is the only time their voice will ever be heard, is through this project. I mean, my family understands it. That's just how it is. Once in a while, they'll go with me. But, you know, they need the break too, Terry. They need the break.
Oh, I can see why.
They don't mind if I'm gone. Sometimes they ask me when I'm going again.
Well, Joe Satori, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Really enjoyed it.
Joel Sartore speaking to Terry Gross in 2017. He's a photographer for National Geographic, attempting to document all of the world's creatures in an ongoing project he calls the Photo Arc. When he spoke to Terry 2 years ago, he had photographed some 6,500 species. Since that interview, that number has climbed to almost 10,000. His newest book in the Photo Arc series, titled Vanishing, came out this month. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews the DVD reissue of the 1958 movie musical Damn Yankees. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from ADP, an HR partner committed to designing a better way to work with HR, talent, time, benefits, and payroll, informed by data and designed for people. Learn more at design.adp.com. And from Westin Hotels and Resorts, offering a range of wellness options for guests, including their Eat Well menu, on-demand fitness gear lending program, and signature Heavenly Bed. Learn more at Westin.com, a member of Marriott Bonvoy.
This is Fresh Air. Earlier this year, an Emmy-nominated TV miniseries drama called Fosse Verdon told the story of the complicated personal and working relationship of two Broadway legends, choreographer Bob Fosse and dancer Gwen Verdon. Sam Rockwell played Fosse, and Michelle Williams, who just won an Emmy for her role, played Verdon. In real life, the actual Fosse and Verdon first collaborated on the 1955 musical Damn Yankees. And Warner Archive has reissued the DVD of the movie version. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, has a review.
Now listen to me. This game of baseball is only one half skill. The other half is something else. Something bigger. You gotta have heart. All you really need is heart. When the odds are saying you'll never win, that's when the grin should start. You gotta have hope.
The musical Damn Yankees opened on Broadway in 1955 and ran for over 1,000 performances. It was the irresistible dancer Gwen Verdon's first starring role, and she would win a Tony. The choreographer for Damn Yankees was Bob Fosse, who had appeared in several movie musicals and had only the year before made his Broadway debut as a choreographer in The Pajama Game, which also ran for over 1,000 performances. Fosse's scintillating choreography for the song Steam Heat became a dance landmark. The songs for both The Pajama Game and Damn Yankees were by the same songwriting team, Richard Adler and Jerry Ross, whose hit songs for these shows included Hey There, Hernando's Hideaway, You Gotta Have Heart, and Whatever Lola Wants. Adler and Ross were on their way to becoming Broadway's next Rodgers and Hammerstein, but tragically, Ross died of a lung ailment at the age of 29. Damn Yankees is the story of a middle-aged baseball fan named Joe, who sells his soul to the devil to become a great young player who can help his team, the Washington Senators, win the championship. But when Joe misses his wife and wants out of the agreement, the devil sends in Lola, Gwen Verdon, of course, whose motto is, whatever Lola wants, Lola gets. But instead of seducing Joe, she falls in love with him. Most of the original Broadway cast joined Verdon in the film, though Broadway's original Joe was replaced by teen idol Tab Hunter, who's not much of an actor here, although his sincerity is touching. Verdon's comic Spanish accent and cartoonish Fosse striptease make the song more a parody of a seduction, unlike the smoky hit recording made by Sarah Vaughan. Here's Gwen Verdon in the movie.
Whatever Lola wants, Lola gets. And little man, little Lola wants you. Make up your mind to have no regrets. Recline yourself, resign yourself, you're through. I always get...
The devil, called Mr. Applegate, is played by the sly Ray Walston, probably best known for playing the title role in the 60s TV show My Favorite Martian. In the movie, as in the show, his big solo is a parody of an old-time vaudeville number. Those were the good old days. in which he celebrates some of the world's worst atrocities.
I see cannibals munching, a missionary luncheon. The years may have flown, but the memory stays, like the hopes that were dashed when the stock market crashed. Yeah, those were the good old days. I'd walk a million miles or more for some of the glory of those good old days.
The main reason this is a must-see movie is a number the Fosse-Verdon TV series devotes practically an entire episode to. Before the Broadway opening of Damn Yankees, the producers decide to cut a big production number, which enrages Fosse. But when Adler comes up with a new tune, he lights up. It's called Who's Got the Pain, and it pokes fun at the grunting noises that come with the latest dance craze, the mambo. On TV, Michelle Williams and Sam Rockwell dance together in the Broadway show. In fact, on Broadway, Fosse was only the choreographer and never appeared on stage at all. But in the movie, Fosse, in a cameo role, and Verdon actually dance together. The number has nothing to do with the story, but they are electric. Every one of their body parts seems to be simultaneously in motion. Even their eyes are dancing together. For 3 minutes and 39 seconds, Who's Got the Pain captures these two Broadway icons at the beginning of their relationship and at the height of their power.
Who's got the pain when they do the mambo? Who's got the pain when they go erp? Who's got the pain when they do the mambo? I don't know who. Do you? Who needs a pill when they do the mambo? Who needs a pill when they go erp? Who needs a pill when they do the mambo? I don't know who. Do you? Someone must be sick with the heat, or stepping on everyone's feet. But if everyone's feeling okay, why don't they just say ole when the music carries them away? Erp! Who's got the pain when they...
Thanks to YouTube, you can see Bob Fosse and Gwen Verdon dancing together on a number of 50s TV shows. But the movie version of Damn Yankees is the only time they dance together on the big screen, and their sparks set it on fire.
Lloyd Schwartz teaches in the Creative Writing MFA program at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He reviewed the movie version of the Broadway musical Damn Yankees, available now as a Warner Archive DVD. Coming up, I review The Politician, the new Netflix series from Ryan Murphy. It stars Ben Platt from the Broadway musical Dear Evan Hansen. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bean Cooley. Today on Netflix, the streaming service presents its newest TV series, and at the same time, employs its latest not-so-secret weapon. That weapon is Ryan Murphy, co-creator of Netflix's new 8-part comedy drama, The Politician. Netflix, as part of its aggressive programming strategy, has begun signing some of TV's most successful producers. Murphy, whose resume includes Glee, Feud, and American Horror Story, is one. Shonda Rhimes, creator of Grey's Anatomy, is another. The idea is to weaken the competition by hiring away their biggest talents, something CBS did back at the very dawn of television, so it's by no means a new move. But it also counts on those talents to deliver. And with The Politician, Ryan Murphy and his collaborators Brad Falchuk and Ian Brennan have delivered a very mixed bag. The politician in the title is Ben Platt, the dynamic star of Broadway's Dear Evan Hansen. He plays Peyton Hobart, a privileged California high schooler who dreams of attending an Ivy League school and much, much more. Well, they're more than just dreams. They're expectations, as he explains to his school dean.
It was a waking dream, the kind that arrives in the twilight between sleep and the real world. I sat straight up in bed and said out loud, I'm going to be president of the United States.
It does seem to be the hot job everyone aspires to nowadays. The air of impossibility has been removed.
Yes, well, I had that dream when I was 7 years old, Dean Lawrence, and I spent my entire life studying the lives of former presidents in order to identify common experiences and traits that led to their inevitable election victories.
Such as?
Well, I only went back as far as Ronald Reagan because, as far as I'm concerned, he created the modern presidency, the presidency of television and celebrity. People like to think of their presidents as characters they see on TV. Most never actually see them in real life. Reagan and Bush Sr. were both presidents of their senior classes in high school.
Which I assume you are on your way to accomplishing.
I believe I have the election well in hand, yes.
To fulfill his long-term ambitions, Peyton sets his sights on winning the race for high school president. Even though he's so calculating and aloof and relatively unpopular, he thinks he can win, with the right campaign team and polling data, the perfect running mate, and the most resonant issues. These will range over the course of the campaign from gun control and teen suicide to celebrity concerts and plastic straws. And just as Peyton's focus shifts wildly from issue to issue, Murphy's The Politician shifts wildly too. Its plot twists arrive at an unsettlingly rapid pace, and its characters are just as erratic. As an overall piece of television, The Politician seems to borrow from several familiar sources, from Election and Murphy's own Glee to the recent Hulu series The Act. Some scenes and characters are exaggerated and caricatured. Others play for sincere drama, asking us to take the plots and people seriously, even when surrounded by absurdity. But where Murphy always has been at his best is at showcasing his actors and allowing them to shine. With Ben Platt, he not only gives the young actor plenty of chances to play either sweet or smarmy, he finds several excuses over the course of the season for the musical theater star to sing. In the pilot, he sings a Joni Mitchell song beautifully. Later on, he sings a Billy Joel song and even a number from Stephen Sondheim's Assassins. And Murphy is showcasing other favorite players as well. Gwyneth Paltrow, who appeared in a recurring role on Glee, plays Peyton's protective, stifled mother. And Jessica Lange, who has stolen many seasons of Murphy's American Horror Story, gets the best role here of all. She plays the grandmother of Infinity Jackson, a seriously ill teen girl, or so it seems, who is pushed around in a wheelchair by her nana. And her nana pushes everyone else around, too, as when she confronts the woman handling restaurant reservations at a crowded Olive Garden, as other patrons watch while waiting for their own tables. Zoe Deutsch plays Infinity.
Infinity, say hello to Karen.
Hello, Karen.
Hi.
You were really looking forward to eating here, weren't you, baby doll?
Uh-huh.
Hell, I said, let's go to Coco's. I was so excited. I love me some of that Coco's pot pie. No, but you dug in. You said,
I want Olive Garden, Anna.
I just got my feeding tube taken out. And my nana said, sure, yeah. You want endless breadsticks? Let's go for it.
Why don't you tell Karen about your cancer? You're in pain sometimes, aren't you?
I'm sorry, I couldn't help over here. We're ahead of you, but we'd really like you to have our table.
Oh, no. Oh, no,
please,
we couldn't possibly
please.
Do that.
I insist. We'd also like to pay for your meal.
It's always fun to watch Jessica Lange, and she throws herself into this role with so much enthusiasm and abandon, it's impossible not to be entertained by her. But the rest of The Politician doesn't draw you in as much. You watch all its twists and turns and sudden mood shifts, but without really caring about or even believing the characters. And Murphy, who almost always starts new series stronger than he ends them, appears to get bored with this series' premise about halfway through and reboots it once or twice before the 8-episode season is over. And as it ends, preparing for a season 2, it reboots again, with Bette Midler and Judith Light showing up only for the season finale. Whether The Politician ends up being a success for Netflix will depend on its short-term buzz and long-term views. Creatively, season 1 is better than the last few seasons of American Horror Story, but not as good as Feud. The Politician already succeeded for Netflix, however, in one key regard. It's Ryan Murphy's newest TV series, and it's not on FX or Fox. It's on Netflix. On Monday's show, our guest will be actor Antonio Banderas, who has had a long collaboration with the great Spanish filmmaker Pedro Almodóvar. It began after the death of Spain's longtime dictator Franco, when it was possible to break old rules. Banderas now stars in Almodóvar's new film, Pain and Glory, as a director dealing with physical and psychic pain. Almodóvar based the character on himself. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, with its skills tests, built for employers who want to see a deeper sense of the person behind the resume. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from Progressive Insurance, offering its Home Quote Explorer, so shoppers can evaluate options in one place when buying home insurance. Custom quotes and rates are available online. Learn more at Progressive.com.